we looked at a lesson we called Dare to Be a Daniel. We saw that Daniel was a man of purpose, Daniel was a man of principle, Daniel was a man of purity, and Daniel was a man of prayer. What a noble example to follow. I want us to look at some things in the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel as we look at this aged Daniel before the king. Now, we're going to look at some things before we get to the fifth chapter, but you might be putting a marker there at chapter 5, and we'll come to that in just a moment. I remind you that Daniel was an exile prophet. In the Old Testament period, we divide prophets by the time period in which they fit. That is, they were either pre-exile, like Isaiah and Jeremiah and those prophets. And then there are exile prophets, and then there's post-exile prophets, such as men like Nehemiah would fit into the period of the post-exile period in Ezra. Daniel fit right in the exile period. In fact, he spanned that entire time. When they went into captivity, they went in groups. And the first group to go in was in 606 B.C., and Daniel was in the first group that went, as we see in Daniel chapter 1. Now, Daniel lived through the whole Babylonian captivity. That is, he spanned from the time they went in, and he saw the Babylonian captivity come to an end. So Daniel lived there for 72 years. He outlived the 34-year reign of Nebuchadnezzar the king, and those that followed thereafter in the Babylonian Empire. He saw the Medo-Persian Empire rise. So he saw a great deal during the 72 years. Daniel lived to see Babylon fall to the Medes, that is, the Medo-Persian. He lived to see the remnant leave for Jerusalem, led by Zerubbabel, as we see in Nehemiah chapter 10. Can you imagine being one of those that saw the captivity come, and they go into captivity, and he's one of the first ones to go? And then he lives to see the day 70 years later when they're returning and going back to their land. Daniel saw all of that. So when the book opens in the book of Daniel, Daniel's a young man, as we mentioned last week, but by the time the book closes, in fact, by the time we get to chapter 5, our study tonight, he is an aged man. This book of Daniel links the pre-exile and the post-exile period because he spans the whole captivity. So Daniel was there in the pre-exile period, he's there in the post-exile period, and he spans the entire period in the book of Daniel. I want to give a quick overview of the book of Daniel to see where chapter 5 fits to help us to better understand some things that are referenced back from chapter 5. The book of Daniel divides itself into two sections. Chapters 1 through 6 we call the historical events, and then there's the prophetic visions that end the book beginning at chapter 7 through the end of the book in chapter 12. In the historical events, there are two sections of that. There is the Babylonian rule period, chapters 1 to 5, and we'll end there in just a second. And then there's the Medo-Persian period, the test of the lion's den. That was under the Medo-Persian rule in chapter 6. So in chapters 1 through 5 has to do with the historical events, and we're going to quickly run through those, and then we're going to focus on Belshazzar's feast and the fall of Babylon in chapter 5. So let's quickly run through chapters 1 to 4, kind of an overview of what we've seen thus far. In chapter 1 of the book of Daniel, we have Daniel's test as a young man as he's taken captive. And so Daniel's test was that Daniel and his three friends were selected for special training. They refused to defile themselves with the king's delicacies, as we talked about in our last study, but God rewarded them. And that's chapter 1. We come to chapter 2, we have the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He was the king of Babylon. He was that wicked king. We'll see more about Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 in a moment. But he had this great dream that you remember was interpreted by Daniel, which was a prophecy of the four world empires, and out of which then in the fourth world empire would be the coming of the kingdom of God. And so he reveals that to Nebuchadnezzar the king. Chapter 3 was the faith of Daniel's friends was challenged and was vindicated. You remember that there was the temptation to bow down before the king. There was the decree. And consequently, their faith was declared. It was tested. Their faith was triumphant in chapter 3. But I'm more interested in chapter 4 because chapter 5 points back to some things in chapter 3. And this is where Nebuchadnezzar was taught that God rules in the kingdoms of men. That goes throughout the entire book. God rules in the kingdoms of men. Chapter 4, verse 25. That's just one of the many passages where indeed that is uttered throughout the book. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, the text tells us. The interpretation of the dream was given, but I'm interested in the fact that in the fulfillment of that dream, beginning at verse 28, we have Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation. How that God had told him that he would finally learn, verse 25 and 32, that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he will. Now you remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar at verse 33, that he was driven out, And he ate grass like an oxen, and his body became wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair grew like the eagle's feathers, and his nail like a bird's claws. He became more like an animal grazing out into the field. And so God humiliates him, because he has never understood the principle that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And now the rest of the chapter, chapter 4, is the fact that Nebuchadnezzar now is praising God and recognizing that indeed he does rule in the kingdoms of men. Now here is a list of some of the kings of Babylon, starting with Nebuchadnezzar, or the one just before Nebuchadnezzar. We won't go through the whole list, but I want you to notice that in chapter 5, we've come now to the time when Belshazzar is the king. He was the son of Nabonidus. Nabonidus ruled from 555 to 536 B.C. The son of Nabonidus, Belshazzar, was a co-regent in the last few years of Nabonidus' reign. And so that's where he comes to play. This is toward the end of the Babylonian rule. So when we read in this chapter, we'll read about Nabonidus, or not Nabonidus, but we'll read about Belshazzar, and a statement is made about his father, Nebuchadnezzar. It's not talking about his immediate father, but it's his ancestor that goes way back. So I'm just showing you the list of the kings of the empire of Babylon. So let's turn to chapter 5, if you're not already there, and let's start working our way through some things in chapter 5. And I want us to understand that Daniel now, in chapter 5, is an aged man. We said the book opens on the scene that Daniel indeed is a man of about 18 to 20 years of age. But by the time we get to this point in the book of Daniel, he's 80 to 90 years old. He's an aged man. And now he's before the king. So here's an outline of the book, or chapter 5 of the book of Daniel. And let's work through that, and then we're going to glean some lessons from that. So beginning at verse 1, we see Belshazzar's feast. What happens here is that Belshazzar the king had made a great feast. Now we've identified who he was. But he made a great feast for thousands of his lord, and he drank wine in the presence of thousands, and he tasted of the wine, which Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and the silver vessels, which his father, that is, your footnote will say ancestor, Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple that had been in Jerusalem, and that the kings and the lords and their wives and the concubines might drink from them. Now, verse 3, we won't read every verse, but I want you to get the gist at verse 3, that they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple. Verse 4 said they drank wine, and they praised the gods of the gold and the silver and the bronze and iron and wood and stone. And that's verses 1 to 4. Belshazzar has this great feast. They're drinking all their wine. They have the items that have been taken from the temple, and they're profaning the use of that which God had established for his purpose. They're profaning in that and using that. But they're not praising the God of heaven. They're praising the gods of the gold and the silver and the stone and wood, etc. And they have their wives and their concubines drinking and getting drunk. Now, beginning at verse 5, there's a handwriting on the wall. So let's look at verses 5 to 9. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite of the lampstand on the plaster on the wall in the king's palace. And the king saw part of the hand that wrote. I want you to notice now the king's reaction. This is a powerful king. He's at least a co-regent, but he's ruling as a king. King Belshazzar is the powerful king of the most powerful kingdom on earth at the moment, the Babylonian Empire. Notice how he reacts when he sees the man's handwriting on the wall. Not a man writing on the wall, but just a handwriting. His reaction at verse 6 was that his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked together. Here's a man just shaking, and his knees are shaking, and his hips are, joints are out of joint. He is just shaking all over. He's scared to death. He doesn't understand what it means. And so he cried out, beginning at verse 7, for his astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers and the wise men of his, that whoever has the reading can read and give the interpretation, that he might be clothed with purple, that's royal cloth, and a chain be put around his neck and made the third ruler of the kingdom. That was an honor that only the king could bestow. I'm going to give him the greatest honor whoever can come and read that writing and interpret that for me. Tell me what it says and tell me what it means. And all the king's wise men, verse 8, said they couldn't read the writing and nor make it known to the king. Exactly why, we don't know. Why couldn't they read that? Was it of a different style? Why is it that they couldn't read it? Perhaps God had made it such that they could not read it, so that Daniel is going to come on the scene. Verse 9, then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled, and his countenance changed, and his lords were astonished. Everybody's troubled. What on earth is going on? Handwriting on the wall, we can't figure it out. None of the wise men can figure it out. Now let's begin at verse 10. The queen suggests, why don't you go get Daniel? The queen, verse 10. perhaps, we don't know who she is. That does not necessarily suggest that this is Belshazzar's wife. It could have been Nabonidus's wife, which may have been the mother of Belshazzar. Whatever the case may be, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom the Spirit of the Holy God, in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of God." Now, the fact that she remembers way back may suggest that this may be his mother that's doing the talking here, because he's a co-regent, and that would still make her perhaps the queen. But be that as it may, she said that there is none like him, that King Nebuchadnezzar, I'm at verse 11, Your father, the king, made him chief of the magicians and astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers, inasmuch as excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding and interpreting dreams and solving riddles and explaining enigmas were found in Daniel. And so let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation thereof. So she comes up with this idea. You go seek for Daniel because you remember your ancestor Nebuchadnezzar had made him this chief man because he could explain all the interpretations of all the dreams. We saw that in chapter 2. We saw that in chapter 4. Now, beginning at verse 13, Daniel comes in through verse 29. That's a larger section. Daniel gives his interpretation of that. And let's get the gist of that because that's where much of our lesson comes. That Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke to Daniel and said, "Are you that Daniel who was one of the captives of Judah that my father brought in from Judah?" Notice what he said in verse 14, "I have heard of you." You might underline that. At verse 14, again at verse 16, "I have heard of you." I've heard about you, Daniel. Been told about you. That the Spirit of God is upon you, and you that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. The wise men, basically, I might paraphrase verse 15, they've looked at this handwriting on the wall. They can't figure it all out. But I've heard of you, verse 16. That you give interpretation and explain enigmas, and if you can read that, then he goes through the list of what I'll do. I'll give you the chain around your neck, the purple robe, and I'll make you third ruler of the kingdom. We noticed last week that Daniel's explanation to that, or his reaction to that, was, "I'm not interested in all that. I don't care about the robe. I don't care about the chain around my neck. I don't care about the third ruler of the kingdom. I'm not interested in that." But he said, verse 18, "The Most High of God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And because of the majesty he gave him, all the peoples and nations and language trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. And whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down." He was a mighty ruler. He did what he wanted, killed who he wanted, spared who he wanted. That's the kind of king he was. "But when his heart was lifted up, his spirit was troubled with pride, and he was deposed from his earthly throne. And they took his glory from him, and he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like beast, dwelling with the wild donkeys and fed with the grass like oxen, and his body was wet like the dew of heaven, till he knew the Most High ruled in the kingdoms of men and appointed it to whomever he chooses." This is interesting now, verse 22. "But you, his son," not literally his son, but you're his descendant, "have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." You knew that. You remember that. "And you've lifted yourself up," verse 23, "against the Lord of heaven and brought the vessels." If I might paraphrase verse 23, it's a long verse, "but because you have defiled the temple of God by bringing all the vessels in and praising the gods of the gold and silver, and you've not glorified God, then the finger of the hands were sent from heaven and this writing was given." And here's what that writing says. I'm not sure that's what all Belshazzar wanted to hear. Now, Belshazzar wondered, what does this say and what does it mean? He gave him the background behind that. And now he says, here's what it says. "The writing is, meeny, meeny, tickle, eupharsin." Well, what on earth does that mean? Verse 26. "The interpretation of each word is meeny. You are numbered. God has numbered your kingdom and has finished it. Tickle, you've been weighed in the balances and are found wanting. And Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." And so Belshazzar gave the command, bring him and make him third ruler of the kingdom, give him the robe and give him the chain around his neck. Now, that brings us to the end of the chapter, Belshazzar's fall, because that's exactly what had been prophesied in this. What happened? "That very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was slain." That was the end of the Babylonian rule. Because Darius, the Mede, received the kingdom being about 62 years old. He's now the ruler. This is the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire. It was the end of the Babylonian rule. That very night he died while he's having this feast. Well, that's Daniel 5. Let's see what we learn from that. Here I learn a lesson about aged Daniel before the king. What do I learn? I learn a lesson from verses 10 to 12 about a man maintaining his integrity. Just like we saw last week, he was a man of purpose. He was a man of prayer. Had all the principles that we've been talking about. Here we see a man of integrity who kept his integrity. He maintained his integrity. Let's go back to verses 10 through 11. This is what the queen said about him. Let me tell you, Belshazzar, about this man Daniel in your kingdom. He goes way back to the day of your great-great-great-grandfather back here. Way back over here to the day of Nebuchadnezzar. He's an old man now in his 80s and 90s, but he was a young man when he came into the kingdom. And he's a man from that day was a man who could explain enigmas and give interpretations. He was a man who served the God of heaven and God, the Spirit of God was upon him. He was a man who all of this time has maintained his integrity, and that's the point I want you to see. He had been faithful for many years. Daniel was faithful from the time he came to the kingdom. He would not defile himself. You remember that in chapter 1? When he came into the kingdom, when he was brought in as a captive, he would not compromise. He would not defile himself. Chapter 3, his friends would not bow to the pressure. He maintained his faith in chapter 6, a little later than this. When he was told not to worship the God of heaven, he defied the rule and he said, I'll worship God. And he went and did that. Three times a day he prayed unto God. He was a man of integrity. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 11. Here's what I'm learning from that. That as a servant of God, you can be faithful all the days of your life. It's not that you have to be hot and then cold and on again and then off again and start and then stop and then start again. You don't have to do that. You can maintain your integrity all the days of your life like Daniel did. Daniel was serving God. He didn't quit serving God. He maintained his integrity throughout. Hebrews chapter 6 and in verse 11. You well understand the book of Hebrews is written from the vantage point of encouraging discouraged Christians. And here's one of the things it said. And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope till the end. You can do that. You can be diligent right to the end. You can keep pressing on. And keep pressing on and be exactly what God would have you to be. I want you to notice that Daniel did that in the midst of a difficult environment. Daniel had maintained his integrity throughout that entire period. This is now at the end of the Babylonian rule. He had been there for 70 years. And all through that time, here's a difficult environment. He was in captivity. He was a prisoner of war. But he never gave up his integrity. He maintained his faith. He had been tested. He had been tried. He had been threatened. And he maintained his integrity. It wasn't easy for Daniel. It won't be easy for you, as we noticed this morning. But you stop and think about what testimony an aged saint of God, and an aged and an old faithful servant of God is. When someone obeys the gospel in their youth and they've been serving for a little while, that's great testimony. But not the kind of testimony when you find that person has been faithful for years and now as an aged person they've kept the integrity they've had since their youth. You think about that. And what kind of statement that made to the people around Daniel that they recognized this is the Daniel that was faithful to God in his youth. He's still faithful to God in his old age, and he's never give up his integrity. Will that be able to be said of you when you get to be old? Maybe you're now in your youth, and when you get to be 70 and 80 and then into your 90s, will some queen somewhere remember, I remember this person when they came and when they obeyed the gospel and they still have that same kind of faith they've always had. That's the kind of man Daniel was. Let's go to verse 16. I learned in Daniel 5 something about reputation. And what I learned about it, the reputation, I want you to notice at verse 16, if you haven't already underlined that, that the king said, I have heard of you. He said that at verse 14. I've heard of you. Are you that same Daniel? I've heard of you. Then again at verse 16, I have heard about you, and here's what I've heard about you. Daniel had a reputation. He had built a reputation over all these years. Belshazzar said, I've heard about you. I want to suggest you have a reputation. People are watching you. They were watching Daniel. Not just the people of God, but the people of Babylon were watching Daniel. People are watching you. They're talking and taking note about you. They're taking note of the things that you say, and they're taking note of the things that you do, and others are talking about you. Somebody's been talking about Daniel. The queen had. But from the discussion of verses 10 through 12, she wasn't the only one talking about that. It is implied that others had been talking about this reputation that Daniel had. I have heard about you, he said. Have people heard about you? You see, your reputation spreads. Word gets around, whether good or bad. Word had gotten around about Daniel. The kind of man that he was. The kind of spirit that he had. The abilities that he had. The things he could do. The insight that he had. That had spread around. Let's look at a couple of passages. Proverbs 22 and in verse 1. And a very similar passage in Ecclesiastes 7 in verse 1. Both talk about a good name, a good reputation. A good name is better than great riches, the proverb passage says in chapter 22 and verse 1. A good name is of greater value than having an abundance of riches. Do you have a good name? When someone comes and says, I have heard of you, what would they say? The passage in Ecclesiastes says that a good name is better than precious ointment. Better than something of great value. You have a good name. And when someone walks up in your community or where you work or at school or wherever it may be or in the family and said, oh yeah, I have heard of you, what would they say about you? What have they heard? Have they heard the kinds of things like the queen would report about Daniel, or have they heard some things that you'd rather them not hear about that? I have heard about you, he said. What have they heard? What have they heard about you? What are people hearing about you? And what are people talking? People do talk about you, whether you recognize that or not, or whether you like that or not. People are talking about you, and they're hearing things about you. What are they hearing, and what are they saying? But here's something else. I want you to go back to verse 16, and I see a case of a man who was ready with an answer. I will recognize that in this case, God was with Daniel, providing him the interpretation thereof, but notice what the king said. I have heard about you that you give interpretation and explain enigmas. That's the kind of man you are. That's exactly what the queen had said over here in verses 10 to 12. This Daniel can explain. He's given interpretations to your father Nebuchadnezzar. He explained the riddles and the dreams and visions that he had. Gave the interpretation thereof. That's the kind of man that he is. So the king said, I've heard about you that you can give an answer. You see, Daniel was known for giving answers to difficult matters. That's what Daniel could do. The question is, are you ready to give an answer? Are you like Daniel? That when someone said, I've heard about you, that one of the things they say they've heard is that you're able to give me some direction as far as answers to the questions that I have. Do you remember 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15? Be ready always to give an answer to the reason of the hope that is within you. That is not a passage that is saying that you have to know all the answers to every question that's ever raised. That's not the point of the passage. But we need to have some kind of defense for being able to say, here's why I believe what I believe. Not that I'll have to go find out why I believe that. But why do you believe what you believe? When someone asks you a fundamental question about your faith, can you give a reason for that? Have they heard about you? So that someone that you work with, you go to school with, said, I've heard about you and your faith, and I understand you can give me the answer to the question I have about why you believe what you believe. Can you give a ready answer for the reason that you believe that God exists? If someone came to you and said, I understand you are one of those that believe in God, would you have a ready answer? Well, I believe in God because. How would you finish that? Or would you answer saying, I believe in God, well, just because, well, I just do. I've always been taught there was a God. Or do you have a reason for believing? What would you say to that? Have they heard about you? Do you have a ready answer why you believe the Bible is true? If someone said, do you really believe that stuff in the Bible? Do you believe this to be true? Do you have an answer that you can point to and you say, I believe the Bible to be true because, and here's my evidence thereof. What would you say? Have they heard about you? Or maybe someone struggles with that and they want you to help them. Can you help them to understand why the Bible is the true, the Word of God, it's inspired of God? Do you have an answer that you could give a ready answer as to why you believe Jesus is God? Someone may say, I believe in the Bible, but I don't believe Jesus is the Son of God. Can you show from your Bible and can you help them to understand Jesus is the Son of God and why you believe that? What evidence could you cite? Have they heard about you? Do they turn to you for answers because they think you have answers? Are you ready to tell them why you believe there's one church? I hear you're one of those that think there's only one church. Could you show them why? Are you ready to give an answer of what is right on divorce and remarriage, or whatever the question that might be of the hour? Do you read and do you study and do you listen with the intent of learning so I can explain to others? Quite often we learn from the vantage point, is this something that applies directly to me? If it doesn't apply directly to me, I don't need the information. Do you ever study from the vantage point, I want to learn this, even though this may not fit my life at the moment, that I might help somebody else to understand? I can explain this passage. I can give the reasons for thus and so. I can explain the difficulties of this complex passage. I want to understand. So that people come and say, I've heard of you. I want to know the explanation. Here's something else I learned from this case in Daniel 5 about learning from the failures of others. Let's go to verse 18. I learned a lesson about learning from the failures of others. Beginning at verse 18. When the king said, I've got this handwriting on the wall, I need somebody to explain that. Daniel doesn't run over to the wall and say, well, let's see what it says. He goes back and talks about the mistake of Nebuchadnezzar. Let me tell you about your father, Nebuchadnezzar. What about my father? Well, here's what was said about Nebuchadnezzar. Remember verse 18? That God made him the ruler, allowed him to be the ruler, gave him glory and honor. And he rose to such power, he did whatever he wanted to do, trampled over anybody that he wanted to trample over, had great power so that people shook and feared before him. But then God drove him from his kingdom and made him to eat grass like an oxen. Look at verse 22. But you, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. Belshazzar knew about Nebuchadnezzar, and yet he did the very same thing. He didn't say, look at verse 22 again, although you knew all this. He didn't say, you probably don't remember about Nebuchadnezzar. He's a little earlier than your time. It wasn't his immediate father. So he doesn't say, well, I know you don't know this, and so let me tell you what happened. This is what happened to him. That's why the kingdom was taken away from him. That's not what he says. He says, I know you know it. I know you know that. And yet you've turned around and you've done the same thing. You're no better than he is. You didn't learn. We ought to be learning from the failures and the mistakes of other people. Let's turn in our Bibles to two or three passages that may help us to understand that. Romans chapter 15 and in verse 4. Do you ever wonder why? What's all this stuff we do on Wednesday nights of studying through the Old Testament? What's the value of that? We go through the Judges. We just finished that. Now we're into Samuel. And why do we need all that stuff anyway? What value? We don't live by the laws that Samuel lived by and the Judges lived by. Here's why. Whatever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. We're supposed to learn something from it and learn from their mistakes and from their failures that we don't repeat the same thing. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Having given the illustration of the children of Israel who came out of Egyptian bondage and fell in the wilderness, the same point that was made in Hebrews 3 this morning. Beginning at verse 6, he said, now these things happened as examples to the intent that you should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as some of them, as it is written, they sat down to eat and drink and they rose up to play. Nor commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day fell 23,000. Nor tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor murmur as some of them murmured and were destroyed of the destroyed. And all these things happened as an example and was written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the age have come. What's his point? Don't do what they did. They didn't obey God and they were punished and therefore don't fall in their same mistake. They ought to learn. That's his point. Let's go to one more passage along that line. Hebrews chapter 4. This is in that same warning that we started this morning and we'll finish next Lord's Day morning in the book of Hebrews. Look at chapter 4 and verse 11. Having given the illustration of how the Israelites come out of bondage and they fell in the wilderness before they reached their promised land, he said, let us therefore be diligent to enter into rest, lest anyone fall after the same example of disobedience. Don't do what they did. Learn from their mistakes. Back to Daniel 5. Belshazzar didn't learn. We often repeat the worst of mistakes. We often repeat the worst of mistakes. That's what Belshazzar was doing. Had he looked back at Nebuchadnezzar, he could have seen Nebuchadnezzar didn't give glory to God, and look what happened to him. And I'm not giving glory to God, and the same thing will happen to me, but he didn't learn. He should have. He thinks he can do what Nebuchadnezzar did and get away with it, and he didn't work. How does that work with us? Well, we watch a parent who has little or no discipline or lack of discipline in raising their children, and they're careless in the rearing of their children, and we see those children turn out to the world, and we didn't learn because we come along and we make the same mistakes and we're loose and careless and carefree with the raising of our children, thinking it'll work out different for us than it did for them. We didn't learn. We didn't learn. If you're a young parent, you look around at those parents who haven't done well with their children and see the mistakes they made and don't follow the same examples they made, because your heart will be broken just like theirs were. Or maybe it's in the case of association with the world. We watch people who begin to have associations with the world and they get in the wrong crowd, and the next thing you know, they've given up their faith. And someone asks, what happened? They just got in the wrong crowd. And then we get in the same kind of crowd thinking it's going to be different for me. We didn't learn from the mistakes of others. We watch as others marry non-Christians, and it doesn't fare too well for them. To say the least, if the marriage survives, it's a strain in the relationship. And then we turn around and it's going to be different for me this time because my marriage is different than theirs, and it doesn't turn out any better. We don't learn from the mistakes of others. We watch somebody play with fire. Proverbs 5 and verse 8. The warning was given to this young man who kept toying with the harlot. Do not go near the door of her house. You're playing with fire. You're going to get in trouble. And we watch somebody play with fire and they get in trouble. And we turn around and we do the very same thing they did. And we have the same kind of disaster. What I learned from Daniel chapter 5 is Belshazzar should have learned from the mistakes of others. But here's something else from that very same verse, verse 22. People do not always do what they know. People do not always do what they know. That explains the puzzle when we say, well, he surely knows better. Have you ever seen someone who is doing something that you think, how on earth could he do that? Surely he knows that's wrong. I don't understand. How could he do that? And the answer is not always. Whether he knows, people just don't always do what they know they ought to be doing. It is not always a question of whether it's wrong or they know it to be wrong. They still do what they know to be wrong. Belshazzar knew better. Go back to chapter 5 and verse 22. He said, although you knew all this, you knew you shouldn't be living the way you are, Belshazzar. You knew you shouldn't be honoring the gods of the gold and the silver and etc. But you still do that anyway. Do you realize that most of our problems and most of the sin come from doing things that we know better than to do? There's not much among us where we're engaged in sin where we're just totally ignorant of the fact that that's sinful. Most of the sin we engage in, we know better than. But we do that nonetheless. We need to be doers of the word and not hearers only, James 1 and verse 22. Do you realize David knew better? 2 Samuel chapter 11, when David committed the sin with Bathsheba, David knew better before he did that. I'll tell you another example. Achan knew better, Joshua 7. Did you not realize that Achan knew he was not to partake of the accursed thing and he did it anyway? That's why he went and hid it. Didn't tell anybody until he got caught. And do you realize that Peter knew better in Galatians 2 when he acted like a hypocrite? He had preached against that very thing. And now he won't associate with the Gentiles? Peter knew better. Achan knew better. David knew better. Tells me we need to take heed. Let's turn to Romans chapter 10 and beginning in verse 3. Often we ignore what we know. It is not always a matter of knowing. Not always a matter of information. Sometimes we ignore what we know. That's the point of Romans 10 and verse 3, verse 17. Verse 3, for they being ignorant of God's righteousness. Talking about the Jews, by the way. They being ignorant, that means they ignored it. They being ignorant of God's righteousness, went about to establish their own righteousness. They just ignored God's plan. Look at verse 17. Faith comes by hearing by the word of God in its context. That is saying that they didn't listen to the word that they knew to be true. People don't always do what they know, which means that it very well may be with me or you, there may be we're engaged in things that we know is wrong. Not a matter of knowledge, we just don't always do what we know we need to do. Here's something else. We need to be reminded of things that we already know. Perhaps for that very reason we just mentioned. This is what Daniel does to Belshazzar. He relates to him a history story about Nebuchadnezzar. Here's what happened to him. Here's how he rose to glory. Here's how he rose to fame. Here's what he did. Here's where he failed. Here's what happened to him as a consequence. How he went out and ate grass like an oxen. Dew fell upon him and he began to grow basically hair and feathers on his head, nails like an eagle, and he was humbled out as a beast in the field. Verse 22, again, I must remind you, and if you haven't already underlined, although you knew all this. I'm going to tell you anyway. We need to be reminded of what we already know. Remember 2 Peter 1 and verse 12. Peter said, I stir you up by putting you into remembrance. Peter was writing about things that he knew his recipients well understood and they knew. But he said, I want to stir up your remembrance. I want to remind you of things you already know. We need to be reminded of what we already know. We need to hear the same truth over and over and over again. We need to hear those truths over and over again. You see, if you've been a Christian very long, the preaching and the teaching from the Bible classes ought to sound familiar. When somebody comes to me that's been a Christian for very long and say, you know what, I've heard that before. I may not say it to their face, but I'm thinking, duh, you should have heard that before. You've ought to have heard that before. You think you're going to hear something new all the time? If you've been a Christian very long, you should have heard this lesson before. Does Belshazzar and the case of the feast sound familiar to you at all? You've heard it before. You've read it before. You've studied it before. In every lesson that's found throughout the gospel, the Old and New Testaments, there is no harm. But rather there is some good and some help that comes from studying a lesson you've studied before, a chapter you've studied before, and a subject you've studied before. You've never mastered any one of those. None of us have. And so, yes, we may be studying Hebrews 3 again on Sunday morning, and you studied it before. There's some value in that. And the same thing with 1 Samuel chapters 8 through 11 Wednesday night, or whatever the case may be. And you've heard about the one church before, but you need to hear that again. You've heard why we believe there is a God, but you need to hear that again. That's exactly what Daniel told Belshazzar. Although you know all this, I'm going to tell you again. Now, there's some reasons why we need to be reminded. Here's one. Because we have a tendency to forget. If we're not reminded of some basic truth, over a period of time, we raise up a generation, Judges 2, that do not know God. That's exactly what happened. They failed to fulfill Psalm 95, Psalm 78, of teaching the law to the people. And consequently, there rose a generation that didn't know God. They didn't understand. We have a tendency to forget. We often miss the obvious sometimes. Sometimes the very obvious point of a context, we get the story maybe about Noah and the flood, and we read about the ark and how long they were in the ark and the size of the ark, and we may miss the very obvious about obedience. And so we need to hear that story over and over and over again. We need to be reminded because some points finally hit home after. It may be the second time, it may be the third, it may be the fourth, it may be the fifth, it may be the tenth time. And those who do the work I'm trying to do of preaching the gospel, those who teach classes, you face the same thing. Where maybe you hit a point that you hit before and you know you've hit it about 10 times, or maybe now this may be the 20th time you drove that point home, and somebody will be sure to say, now I understand what you're trying to say. What didn't you understand it the first time or the second or the third or the fourth or the fifth? Sometimes it doesn't sink in with any of us. And so, yes, you may have heard that lesson about Acts 15 and Bible authority. You need to hear it again because there's something may sink in this time didn't hit last time. We need those lessons over and over again. Go back to chapter 5, if you will, verse 22. Although you knew all this. Isn't that what every preacher and teacher needs to do? I'm going to tell you about this. Although you know all this, I'm going to tell you again. That's what preachers and teachers need to do. Well, let's look at verse 27 now. When it came to interpreting the handwriting on the wall, the message of the handwriting on the wall was, you are weighed in the balances and you are found wanting. We're going to be weighed and we may be found wanting. You remember what the writing on the wall said? The writing on the wall said, meeny, meeny, tickle, you farson. And so Daniel goes to the wall and says, here's what it says. Meeny, meeny, tickle, you farson. Let me tell you what it means. At verse 27, he said the word tikkun means you have been weighed in the balances and you are found wanting. God takes what He expects out of you, and here's what you are, and when God weighs those out, you're found deficient. There's something missing. God's weighing you. There's two things I want you to see in that. We will be weighed, just like He was weighed. We face a judgment ahead. All of us appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive the things done in our body, whether it be good or bad. The whole chapter, chapter 10, I cite verses, chapter 2 of Romans, I cite verses 8 through 10, but the whole chapter is devoted to the judgment scene. Where some are going to be judged unto everlasting life, some into damnation, there is a judgment that's coming. And that's the thing the Jews did not understand in Romans chapter 2, that they're going to be weighed, just like the Gentiles they thought would be weighed. In Revelation chapter 20 and verse 12, let's notice this one last passage. In Revelation 20 and in verse 12, here is a picture of a judgment scene that I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to the things that were written in them according to the books. There's a judgment day coming in which we're going to be weighed. And God's going to hold out, and here's what I expected of you, and here's what you did, and how do you weigh out? We're going to be judged, just like Belshazzar was judged. But here's what happened with Belshazzar. He was found wanting. Will you be found wanting? When he was weighed out, he was found deficient. He didn't measure up to what God expected. When you put what he was with what God expected of him, he was found deficient. And he was wanting. Will you be found wanting? What's missing in your life? If God put your life of what he expected on one side, and on the other side of the scale, he put what you are. Are you deficient? Is there something missing in your life that you obviously know? There's a big deficiency here that I know I'd be found wanting. What is that? And why aren't you doing something about it? What are you not doing now that you know you need to be doing? Is there something you know? There apparently was something with Belshazzar. You say, how do you know? Before Daniel said you were weighing the balance and found wanting, he said you knew what Nebuchadnezzar was and you turned out to be the same way. You knew better than that. You knew what was deficient. You knew what was lacking. You were not honoring the God of heaven like he didn't honor the God of heaven. You were deficient in that. You were found wanting. Could you say, I know I should be doing, and you fill in the blank, and you're not doing that? I know I ought to, but I'm not doing that. Are you found wanting? There's some lessons we learned from Daniel chapter 5. What have we learned? I learned about a man who maintained his integrity for over 70 years. From the time he came into the kingdom, the Babylonian Empire, as he was taken into captivity, to the time that captivity was over, he spanned that whole time and he maintained his integrity throughout. I see a man whose reputation was such that the king could say, I've heard about you and here's what I've heard. What he heard was good things. Daniel was ready with an answer, are you? Daniel said, you should have learned from the failures of others. Are we learning from the failures of others? Daniel said, you didn't do what you knew you should be doing. Daniel said, I need to remind you of some things, though you already know them, and you've been weighed, and you are found wanting, and that's God's message. And then the story ends with Belshazzar, not a very favorable way. When the statement was given, which came from God, you are found wanting, you've been weighed in the balances and are found wanting, that very day, the kingdom was taken away and he died. If God were to say to you tonight, you are weighed in the balances and you are found wanting, would that be the end of your story? And if you had a kingdom, would it be taken away? And if we're living in the Old Testament time, would God take your kingdom away and you'd be slain that very night and your kingdom be given to someone else? There may be one more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?